Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. You may have heard that we're all carrying around microplastic particles in our bodies, and that's also true for marine organisms, even those living in seemingly pristine environments that look absolutely clean and healthy. Our guest this week is Zeke Spooner. Zeke is a PhD student working at the Pasparakis Lab, which studies toxicology at the University of Davis's Bodega Marine Laboratory. His area of expertise and study is microplastics and how they build up in marine organisms. He joins us now from the Bodega Marine Lab on the Northern California coast. Zeke Spooner, welcome to Blue Dot. Well, before we get into our topic with you, which is microplastics in the oceans, I'd like to know, a little bit about your background. How did you become interested in studying marine biology, toxicology? Tell us about what you do and what you're studying.
Yeah, well, I grew up in the Monterey Bay area, and being right next to the Monterey Bay and being able to go to the aquarium is what inspired a love of the ocean from a young age. But also when I was growing up, a lot of big environmental issues were really starting to come to light, and that inspired me to go into environmental science and specifically toxicology, seeing stories about all of the pollution going on in the ocean. So I pursued a bachelor's of science in environmental toxicology at UC Davis and aspire to be a professor someday. So I decided to continue my studies in grad school.
And how did you come to be at the Bodega Marine Lab? Tell us what it's like to be there.
Well, the desire to do marine science and be able to go out in the field. Davis is 2 hours away from the coast, but luckily they have this awesome marine station, the Bodega Marine Lab. And so I was able to get in contact with one of the professors who works at the Bodega Marine Lab to collaborate and join their lab and do some of my grad work out here.
And you are part of a toxicology group there, and that's a fairly new lab group. Could you tell us a bit about the group you're working with?
Yeah. So a few years ago, the environmental toxicology department hired Dr. Christina Pasparakis to run a new toxicology lab out here at BML. And so she is one of my advisors, and she's been starting to do projects with aquatic toxicology and also microplastics, a lot of really novel stuff, really exciting stuff going on out here.
And how did you become specifically interested in microplastics?
Well, I mean, I've heard a lot about microplastics over the years being in the environment and found in various parts of, the human body, and seeing plastics strewn about the environment on the beach. So it was an issue that I cared about. I'd done lots of beach cleanups when I was growing up, living right in the Monterey Bay. I saw how dirty it could get and saw plastic pollution. And was very concerned and motivated to try and combat this issue. And in my undergraduate studies, I'd also heard a lot about microplastics and just how they're everywhere and how they can really infiltrate and cause a lot of damage to various kinds of habitats, especially in the ocean.
Well, let's talk about microplastics. And can you explain to us how microplastics differ from just, plastic trash?
Yeah, so there's two main kinds of microplastics. There's primary microplastics, which are designed at that micro scale. And those are the type of microbeads you find in your personal care products and building blocks for larger plastics. But you typically are finding secondary microplastics in the environment more often. And secondary microplastics are breakdown products of larger plastics. So your plastic water bottles, your grocery bags, your synthetic clothing, those types of things making their way into the environment and then breaking down into really small pieces.
And when you say small pieces, give us a sense of the range of size of microplastic particles.
So there's actually a huge range of microplastic particle size, which makes them one reason why they're difficult to study, and also because they have very different properties depending on their size. The general range is roughly 5 millimeters in diameter all the way down to 1 micron in diameter.
That's quite a range. And how do these actually get into the ocean? What are the principal sources that you've observed?
Well, the principal sources are going to be single-use plastic waste that is not recycled and improperly disposed of, that is making its way usually into rivers and other bodies of water or flowing somehow from the land into the ocean.
You also mentioned those personal care products, and I was talking to our producer, Matt Fiddler, the other day about this, and he mentioned back you know, a while ago that he was kind of shocked to find out that these little microplastic beads were in this facial scrub stuff, and thinking, well, you're dumping this all down the drain. Are those still in products, that personal care products today? Are those still being used?
Yes.
Wow. Is there any talk, legislation or anything to, you know, that trying to get rid of that?
I don't think it's a big thing right now. I'm not actually sure. I think because the vast majority of microplastics that people have detected that are causing issues are these breakdown products more so than the ones manufactured for the personal care products. Personal care products, we could get into a whole different talk about those, because there's a lot of chemicals that are used in personal care products that are also not tested. So you have the microbeads, and then you also have the formulations themselves that need just really a lot more information before decisions can be made.
And at the lab there in Bodega, you're involved in a study that try to, you know, determine how much microplastics are in the environment there. Tell us about that work that you're involved in.
Yeah, so our big project that we are working on right now is trying to determine the extent to which microplastics have infiltrated the Bodega Marine Reserve, which is this beautiful marine reserve, marine protected area that we're able to use for our research projects, and is relatively pristine and safe from anthropogenic impact. But knowing the ubiquity of microplastics in the environment, we are concerned that microplastics are still making their way into this marine protected area and the reserve, and so are still able to cause damage as a result.
And how do you go about a study like this? Tell us about the methodology you use.
So I'll preface this by saying this is a long-term project. So we're actually trying to monitor how these microplastics, if there's a change in microplastics accumulation over seasons and over years. So on a seasonal basis, we go out into the field on the reserve and we sample water from tide pools, sand from tide pools, as well as three different species of algae and a species of sea snail, the black tegula, and then a filter feeder, the California mussel.
And how do you go about determining, you know, what amount of microplastics are in these creatures?
So it's a pretty complicated extraction procedure. So when we collect all of our samples, we take them back to the lab, and then for the tissue, in order to see how much actual microplastics are in the tissue, you kind of have to really break down the rest of the sample, everything except for the microplastic, and then filter out the microplastics that are left. So we use a really strong chemical extraction in order to get out the microplastics from the tissue. The water's a little bit easier. You can just filter that one, and then you're left with this filter that has your microplastics and a little bit of debris, and then you go and pick out the microplastics and look at them under the microscope.
It sounds pretty painstaking. How long does it take once you get a sample to the lab to go all the way through the process and be able to assess the amount of microplastics in there?
Well, it takes a pretty long time. If we're working with a tissue sample, we actually have to freeze dry them for 48 hours first and then do the digestion for another 48 hours. So it's actually 96 full hours before we can even get them on the filter. And then after that, it's a pretty painstaking process, especially if the samples have a lot of microplastics, to pick every microplastic off the filter and then place it on a little grid, this tiny little grid that we can use to organize our microplastics under the microscope.
So when you're organizing them under the microscope, is that how are you able to determine, you know, possible sources that these microplastics that you've found, where they came from?
So With the visual examination, it's pretty difficult. We can determine the basic size, shape, and color, and these are useful information in their own regards, because these often determine if there's any physical damage that the microplastics can cause. You can expect that a microplastic with a fibrous shape is going to have different abilities to move throughout an organism and maybe clog or damage than a fragment. So you get microfibers coming off of synthetic clothing, and, you know, anytime you, in the manufacturing process, or anytime you even open a Ziploc bag and there's that kind of ripping thing, whenever you rip plastic, you can get these little fibers coming off. And then if you have pieces of more brittle plastic, like water bottles, that can get shattered or otherwise broken down into these little fragments. The little fragments are much more likely to scrape up a piece of tissue, for example. Both of them have the potential to kind of can clog guts, for example, in these aquatic organisms. So that gives us some information, but another really useful piece of information that we can't get from the microscopy is what actual types of plastic the microplastics are. And so we actually have to take our samples back to UC Davis main campus and use a technique called Raman spectroscopy in order to identify the chemical properties of these microplastics to have a better idea of what their source is.
And you mentioned some of the species you're studying. Could you kind of go through them again and tell us why those particular species are the ones that you're using?
Yeah, so our goal is to investigate bioaccumulation, specifically this principle of biomagnification, where you see that the body burdens of pollutants in organisms tend to increase with trophic level. So your primary producers and primary consumers have lower amounts of pollutants in them, and your top predators are going to have higher amounts of pollution because of this concentration factor as you go up.
Yeah, that makes sense.
We're expecting to see it with microplastics. It's been well characterized for many other pollutants. So because of that, we selected algae as our primary producer. We selected three different species because we wanted three different morphologies. Microplastics have been observed to have the ability to stick to algae. And so when you have different textures of algae, the ability of microplastics to stick to these different textures of algae can vary. And because out on the reserve, there's a pretty diverse array of algae. And so we're expecting that there's going to be different amounts of microplastics adhering to different kinds of algae. And then we picked the tegula snail in order to see if there is an increase going up the trophic chain from the primary producer to the primary consumer. And this snail also feeds on some of the algal species that we're actually investigating as well. So we're able to make that link, that bioaccumulation link. And then we picked the mussels as well, because they're this filter feeder. And filter feeders are a special case, because if there's microplastics floating around in the ocean, the mussels could mistake them for food particles in their filtration process and accumulate them as a result.
So they, when they're feeding, they sense that they're, you know, something in the water is their potential food source. And so they could be mistaking the plastics for food then.
Yeah, essentially they're flushing water through their bodies and grabbing particles out of the water and trying to consume them. And, you know, unintentionally, I don't know if the mussels are specifically trying to grab any kind of particles, but they're just, if there's microplastics as well as algae, that they're filtering through, then they can grab these particles and then potentially start accumulating them in their gut.
When you're studying these, and we talked about this on the phone the other day, and I found it fascinating, you really have to be careful that you're not contaminating the samples. Can you tell us about the challenges of doing that?
Yes. So contamination is the biggest challenge by far when doing microplastic science. Microplastics are recognized as being ubiquitous in the environment, and that includes on our clothes and in the air that we breathe. They're everywhere. And so as a result, when we're doing all of this field work and lab work, we have to be extra careful to prevent microplastics from entering our samples from our clothing and from the lab. We use a lot of plastic labware for other tasks, but we have to take a few steps in order to make sure that there isn't plastic involved in any step of the process for our microplastic sampling, and that we're taking extra steps to prevent any ambient microplastics from entering our samples. So when we go out in the field, we actually wear bright pink shirts. And the purpose of this is so if we get fibers from these shirts in our samples that we can't distinguish from microplastic fibers, they have this bright pink color that you don't see in microplastics out in the environment very often. So we'll be able to point those out and say, oh, a pink fiber, that's likely contamination from our clothing. And then similarly, when we actually go in the lab, we have these bright orange jumpsuits. And they're all of the clothes that we wear are cotton, because when we do that chemical analysis, we'll be able to tell which particles, even if they're difficult to tell by color, we'll be able to tell that they're not plastic based on the chemical analysis. But for these first steps where it's more difficult to tell before we can even do that chemical part, it's very helpful to be able to have these brightly colored clothes so that we do actually see fibers coming off them and getting into samples. And then we're able to point those out and say, okay, that's an artifact of the sampling process and not something that came from the reserve.
And do you see those bright pinks very often? Is it pretty common to run across them?
Yeah, we're actively working on ways to decrease this. But if you're out in the field for 3 hours, those particles are going to be coming off. And, we take a lot of steps to try and minimize them. Every time before we do lab work, we use a lint roller in all of our clothes to try and get as much fibers off of them as possible. But still, we typically see a couple pink or orange fibers in some of our samples, in addition to some unidentified ones that we think are from the reserve.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with UC Davis PhD student Zeke Spooner from the university's Bodega Marine Laboratory as we discuss microplastics in the oceans. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's return now to our conversation with Zeke Spooner. Zeke is a PhD student at the Pasparakis Lab, which studies toxicology issues and the marine environment at the UC Davis Bodega Marine Laboratory on the Northern California coast. And can you tell us about, I know you're working on this and you're going to have more results in the future, but can you give us a sense of what you guys are finding out there in Bodega?
Yeah, I mean, so right now we are processing our first field sampling, our first set of samples from our first season, which was this winter. And we are expecting to find, and we actually have already been looking at our samples, and we have been finding some unidentified, usually dark-colored fibers. And like I was saying before, the fibers are really interesting. They can come from a lot of different things. They can come from your clothes breaking down, synthetic clothing breaking down. They can come from fishing lines, and they can come from a variety of processes where plastics are kind of ripped or torn. And so we've been seeing some of those in our water samples already. And we're expecting to see those in our other samples as well. And more importantly, we're expecting to see that there's going to be a greater load of microplastics in these tissue samples than there are in the algal samples or in the environmental media samples. And so we're actively working on actually processing these samples. And hopefully we're going to have more data very soon in the next few months that will actually be able to illuminate some of these trends more.
And when you're out in the field doing these studies, is it dawn on you, like just on a personal level, as someone who loves the ocean, grew up in the Monterey Bay area, that you know, for all intents and purposes, when you look at a place like Bodega Marine Lab and Bodega Bay, that whole area there, it just looks so beautiful and pristine and untouched. Yet you know that stuff's there. What's that like for you personally? Do you ever, like, does it dawn on you that, like, yeah, it looks clean, but we know different?
Yeah, it's definitely a strange feeling, because it is very beautiful. And going out on the reserve, we're very lucky to be able to go out on the reserve. It's this beautiful area. There's harbor seals. There's all these great different algal species. There's tons of sea stars and anemones. And it's all this beautiful experience to be able to go out on the tide pools. But then we're looking for these terrible little contaminants that are, for the most part, invisible to the naked eye. But then we're taking water and we're filtering it, and we're seeing plastics everywhere. It's like, it's really unfortunate. The thing about toxicology is that a lot of times it's really difficult to know until you actually go out and you measure just how contaminated even a seemingly beautiful and pristine environment is.
Yeah, because you really can't tell just, you know, from the naked eye looking at something, you know, what kinds of contaminants could be in it. Could look like, you know, nice clean water, and yet there may be all kinds of things in there that you don't know about. And that's one of the unfortunate things of our modern industrial society, is a lot of stuff gets in our waterways.
Yes. And the amount of chemicals, new chemicals that are produced and created every year, it far exceeds the amount of toxicity testing on these new chemicals that scientists are able to do. So with lots of these industrial processes, like you're talking about, it's very difficult for us to keep up with the amount of chemical innovation to make sure that these chemicals are safe, not only for humans, but also for aquatic life and generally wildlife. And so it's a bit of an uphill battle, especially with microplastics, because, you know, I keep on saying microplastics, but they're not just one pollutant. It's this big class that has this great diversity in size, shape, color, and chemical composition. And all of those factors affect the way that these particles are toxic in different ways. And so tackling microplastics pollution is really a monumental task, because, you know, we have to figure out exactly what composition they are and what size, and try and figure out how, what kind of risk there is based on these various factors at play, instead of a single chemical that we can easily characterize with controlled experiments.
And can you give us, like, a sense of maybe a list of the top few that are the most worrisome to you as a scientist?
Yeah. So a lot of the structural additives that are put in plastics are the ones that are oftentimes the most toxic. The classic one is bisphenol A, or BPA. Probably go to the grocery store and see a lot of labels. This lid does not have BPA. This product's not made with BPA, that kind of thing. It's a structural additive. It's very good at what it does. It makes plastic really strong, but also it is an endocrine disrupting chemical, which is this class of toxins that disrupts humans or wildlife's endocrine systems, which can affect signaling pathways, and as a result lead to some serious damage, especially reproductive damage and the ability for organisms to reproduce. BPA in humans is specifically really toxic to infants, which is why there was so much pushback against BPA, and why there's actually legislation able to be enacted preventing its use in baby products, but it still is able to be used in some products. And so we still have risk of this really toxic chemical. The other ones, I would say there's even some plastics that are made with, like, formaldehyde. And formaldehyde is a really terrible chemical for humans. There's other chemicals that are used as plastic additives that are found to be carcinogenic and toxic to the liver. And so there's all these really bad effects. A lot of these chemicals can be really, really toxic to humans. And that part of the science, I would say, is fairly well characterized. Some of the more common plastic additives are being studied for toxicity in a lot of the model systems. But as far as aquatic toxicity goes, there's still a lot of work to be done.
Yeah, I was thinking about when, you know, not very long ago, people really were into drinking water out of plastic bottles. It seems like there's a shift now to where people are starting to use plastic-free containers. I know I do. But when somebody's like, you know, has to grab a bottle of water that it's in plastic, are they possibly ingesting microplastics just by drinking water out of that plastic bottle?
Very likely. I would recommend for anyone, everyone, to try not to use plastic water bottles if you can help it, and use a reusable metal water bottle.
They keep your water colder too, or hot, whatever you want.
Yeah, the insulation is nice as well, yeah, right?
They're just better all the way around.
Studies that have been conducted where people have left. Just scientists have studied how much microplastics are in plastic water bottles when they just leave them out, especially in the sun. If you leave plastic water bottles out in the sun, that can actually increase the breakdown. And sure enough, after like taking the water from these plastic water bottles that have been sitting out for days, scientists find a decent amount of microplastics from the water bottle inside of the water. And so it's very likely if you drink from a plastic water bottle that you're drinking microplastics, which is kind of a scary thought, I know. But generally, the use of single-use plastics are a huge source of microplastics, not only when they make it into the environment, like I was saying before, but also when we use them. And so the less that we can use single-use plastics, the better not only will be for the environment, but for our health in terms of microplastic and minimizing the risks of ingesting microplastics.
And just to, for people to understand that, what would be the common sources of single-use plastic products that people would run into in their daily lives?
Plastic water bottles are a great example, but also wrappers for various kinds of food, Ziploc bags, grocery bags. I mean, the list goes on. Plastic straws. We don't really realize how much plastic we use in our life until we actually kind of sit down and think about every single, like, if you track every single piece of plastic that you use in a day, you're probably going to be shocked. You know, write down every single piece of plastic that you're using. You'll probably be shocked. And we really had to come to terms to this when we were setting up our project. Because we can't use any plastic materials for any of our sampling or any of our processing. And so here we are, and we realize that most labware that we use is plastic, you know, test tubes and that kind of thing. And it's been a real challenge just to get either glass or metal replacements, suitable replacements for everything, instead of using test tubes for samples and the standard kind of very clean plastic jars that we use. We use mason jars, and we use little metal dishes in order to keep all of our samples, and like the spray bottles that you use in order to like spray water or ethanol on something. We can't use those. And so we're having to use, you know, glass in order, you know, glass pipettes to drip these solvents on to try and clean our samples. And it's just this huge like rethinking of how we actually do our science in order to eliminate plastic. Plastic is just everywhere.
Is there any kind of move in the scientific community that you've heard of to, you know, try to reduce the amount of plastics that scientists use in laboratory work every day?
There is some efforts that are being made, I think, to being more sustainable. I will say that it's very difficult for scientists to use non-plastic materials because they're this great standard for clean and reliable and not contaminated and not going to interact. You know, they're stable, they're plastic, so they're not going to interact with the chemicals that people use. But there are some efforts that I've seen where people are trying to, especially in the packaging, minimize the amount of plastic being used. I know in general in the world right now, there's big efforts being made to create bioplastics instead of plastics made from fossil fuels, because these bioplastics are made from renewable plant sources, for example, instead of using, you know, increasing carbon emissions by using fossil fuels, and creating plastics that are able to be broken down a lot more. I think a great example is seeing compostable grocery bags, where you can put your produce in these compostable bags. And then when you're done, you know, topping up all of your fruits and vegetables, and there's all the seeds and the parts you don't want, you can throw them in that bag and throw that bag straight in the compost. I know that kind of thing. I know I've deviated from the lab now and just kind of generally talking about the world, but I'm hopeful that, because I think there's a great amount of innovation going on right now to create, you know, more sustainable alternatives that have the same function and the same ability to be clean and stable and preserve as single-use plastics derived from fossil fuels and petroleum.
Yeah, it seemed like for a while there, plastic bags that you would use at the grocery store were just so ubiquitous everywhere. And being someone who spends a lot of time in and around rivers and streams, you see them, they blow across the landscape and then they wind up in the river and, you know, get hung up on a plant and you see them. And, you know, whenever I find that stuff, I try to pick it up and get it out of the system. But it does seem like people are starting to turn a corner on that, to use, you know, reusable grocery bags that you just use all the time instead of the ones that you get at the store. And now in California, the regular plastic bags seem to be a thing of the past.
Yeah, it's great to see that people are, you know, even instead of using plastic bags, using paper bags. I see a lot more paper bags now. That's great. I do think in California, I've noticed that the amount of plastic bag usage has gone down. I think that's great. And I think there's other areas that we could work on as well. But I think in California, the efforts to reduce single-use plastics, including as far as legislation is going, we're making progress. And it's hard because plastics have been so useful for us as a society. It's hard for us to break from them. But efforts are being made. Lots of research is being done. But we still have a lot of plastic bags out in the environment and they're still breaking down. And so we're keeping our eyes out for filmy microplastics those are the types of microplastics that are probably sourced from plastic grocery bags.
And what do you mean by filmy plastics?
As in they're this kind of, they might have a high surface area, but they're flimsy. They look like a tiny little piece of a bag. They're like a very, very thin kind of particle. And whereas if you have a fragment type particle, that's going to be very rigid.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, fragments versus films. Do you have a sense of like which one's more common, films or fragments?
I mean, I think it depends on where you're looking and what the site is. As for our samples, we haven't seen a lot of either. It's been mostly fiber so far. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think it really depends. If you go to, you know, say there's a creek right next to a bunch of grocery stores, you might be finding a lot more.
Oh yeah. But no, that's for sure.
It really depends on the local environment and what types of plastics are being used and what types of plastics are being disposed of properly and which ones aren't, and that kind of thing.
And you said when you were young, you were involved in some beach cleanup activities and things like that. What are some things that you're doing now to engage the public to try to combat contaminants in the beautiful place where you work?
Yeah, so I am trying to work more with the community, because the issue of plastics pollution is really an issue for that the entire community should know about and be engaged with and has a stake in. And, you know, I have all of this knowledge from reading 18,000 scientific papers on microplastics and all this stuff. And I know I have a different perspective from probably most people who use plastics in their daily lives. And so I'm making an effort to reach out to locals and work with them to clean up beaches, because that is a great way to minimize microplastics and general plastic pollution in marine environments, and try and work with people to see what their perspectives are on the issue and what they're concerned about with regards to plastic and microplastics pollution, and have some conversations so I can have a better idea of what people are concerned about in general and not just what me as a scientist am concerned about.
And from those conversations, give us a sense of what kinds of things you learn from people talking to them.
Well, I think that it's the, you know, as far as microplastics studies, it's the bodies of water that are, you know, right at their doorstep that they use every day that matter the most. I mean, I was talking to one of the docents at BML, and I was telling them about this idea I have for trying to work with some of the community and maybe have them collect samples and try and analyze them to see if there's microplastics in places that people care about. And he was immediately like, well, do you do wells? Can you do my well? And I was like, yeah. And so it's that kind of thing where people are pretty concerned about their local water sources. People, you know, might be concerned about the beaches that they go to every day to maybe walk their dog, yeah, or that kind of thing. And so I'm going to be doing several beach cleanups throughout this year to try and work with people and get an idea of what places they're concerned about and how concerned they are about microplastic pollution, and see if people are excited to try and make a difference.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about microplastics in the ocean with Zeke Spooner from the UC Davis Bodega Marine Laboratory. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's continue now with our visit with UC Davis PhD student and researcher Zeke Spooner from the Bodega Marine Lab as we talk about microplastics in our coastal waters.
I think that educating young people and showing them why plastics are bad and teaching them about microplastics, which might be a hard thing for young people to conceptualize, would be an important, you know, I try not to scare them, but mm-hmm. more in a hopeful manner of like, hey, we have some problems, but everyone can make a difference. Even if you don't think you can make a difference, you can make a difference. There's steps that everyone can take to make a difference. And I do think that the youth are an important aspect of moving away from single-use plastics and combating this plastic challenge.
It can be such simple things too, just, you know, using a reusable grocery bag or choosing a paper bag if that's the only option you have because mm-hmm. you forgot your bag that day or whatever. And using those metal water bottles instead of plastic, instead of just picking up the plastic one off the shelf. Just those simple things that if we all start doing those more would definitely help.
Yeah. Like you're saying, small things, simple things, but they'll add up.
And it is interesting when you said, I think this would be an interesting thing for all of us to do, to be just, you know, have a declare a plastics day in your life where you're just going to notice, okay, everything that you touch and use all day long, you know, just notice all the plastics in your life. And it probably would be pretty shocking, like you said.
Yeah. And then actually trying to make an effort to, you know, trying not to use those plastics might be even more eye-opening, and seeing how difficult it is to find alternatives and realizing how we as a society really depend on plastic right now might be able to help some people with, you know, a change in perspective of like, oh, wow, we're really dependent on this. And, you know, using glass Tupperware and that kind of thing to store food and transport food. And then there's like, you're minimizing plastics on one hand, and then also it's safer because if you're, you know, trying to microwave food in plastics, you know, you don't want to do that. That's a good way to get microplastics or even leachates, where they just leach out the chemicals into your food.
So microwaving things in plastic containers is not a good idea.
Generally, yes. There's some plastics that are deemed microwave safe. But a lot of times I think it's the companies that are saying they're microwave safe. it's worth checking in on, you know, checking in for a certain product and seeing how actually microwave safe something is. But if you're in doubt, don't put a piece of plastic in the microwave.
Yeah, I know that it wasn't too long ago. I got a frozen dinner because I, you know, just didn't have time to cook every night. And it was like a healthy meal kind of thing. Everything looked great. But then when I opened it and I looked at it, there was so much plastic in it that I decided, well, I'm not going to buy this brand anymore. This is just too much plastic that I'm having to waste and use. It's like, no.
Yeah, it's a lot.
It's like, reminds me of the 60s movie, The Graduate, you know, the future plastics. So, oh, no. And he was right. The future is plastics, but it's not all good. Before we let you go, tell us about what are your favorite things about working at Bodega Marine Laboratory? Because it's such a spectacular place.
Yeah, I mean, the view is great. I'm sitting in the library here right now and looking out on the ocean, and it's spectacular. But there's a great community out here. I have a fantastic lab group that I get to work with in Dr. Pasparakis's lab. The research scientist in Dr. Pasparakis's lab. We have a really great group that I just really like to work with a lot. And we're doing some really, really important science, I believe.
Certainly. And can you tell us, are there some other interesting microplastics research projects going on that you can share with us?
Yes. My colleague Jordan Colby he's a master's student in the lab, is working on a project where he's investigating microplastics accumulation in rockfish. And rockfish are a high trophic level species. So this is actually going to be a really great study to go with the BMR monitoring project, because we get that higher trophic level to compare with the lower trophic levels that we're investigating in the reserve. Now, you can't catch fish in the reserve because it's a marine protected area, but Jordan works with the California Collaborative Fisheries Research Program, aka CCFRP, which is this great multi-institutional program in the state of California that monitors the effectiveness of marine protected areas in protecting important fish species. And this program is fantastic. There's six institutions that are part of it, including UC Davis at Bodega Marine Lab, the northernmost one being Cal Poly Humboldt, and the southernmost one being UC San Diego. So we really span the whole state. And as part of this program, Jordan and another master's student in the lab, Francine DeCastro, go out and on a boat and get a crew of volunteer anglers and go into the marine protected area and are able to catch some fish and return them, of course, but count and collect data on how many fish and what kinds of fish, mostly rockfish that are caught, and what size fish, and then go into a reference site nearby outside of the MPA and collect some more fish and see how many fish there are there. And the results are actually pretty shocking. There's the MPAs are working. There's way more fish, and they're typically quite a bit larger in the marine protected areas. So it's a very good thing for everyone to see just how well they're working. But Jordan is able to use his work in this program to be able to get access to a great number of rockfish that he can then sample to see if they're accumulating microplastics. And since they're this high trophic level organism, we're expecting even more microplastics than we would in any of the BMR samples, because rockfish are this principle of biomagnification, like I was talking about before, but also rockfish live for a really long time. And they can live for dozens of years. The oldest rockfish ever recorded was over 200 years old. So wow. They have all the time to accumulate microplastics. And so Jordan's doing that work right now. And it's really exciting to have these two projects going on in the lab in tandem, both of which are also having this collaboration with the community, so that we have that community perspective in our science.
And rockfish are a very popular sport fish in California for coastal fisher anglers. And I had no idea they lived that long. When he's doing these studies, is he able to determine, like when he gets a fish, how old it is?
Yes. So this brings in another collaboration. We're collaborating with NOAA to do aging for the fish. You can age a fish by looking at its ear bones, which are called otoliths. And you can study the otoliths to determine how old the fish is. They're kind of like tree rings, where you can use the specific number of layers to determine how old the fish is.
Yeah, I know. Studying otoliths in salmon, you can determine like exactly what tributary creek the salmon was spawned in.
Yeah, there's a lot of really in-depth stuff that you can do with otoliths. For our research, the age of the rockfish is what matters most, because rockfish aren't migratory. So wherever you catch a rockfish from, that's its home habitat. So the aging part is the really crucial part with the otoliths. And we're expecting that the older fish are going to be probably more contaminated because they have so much more time to be bioaccumulating.
And there's another interesting aspect to that too. If they're, depending on how old they are, the change in the amount of plastics over time that's been going into the waterways.
Yeah.
It's hard to suss all that out, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be some the data is going to be it might be a little bit complicated. But we're hoping that by the end of the project, Jordan's going to be able to tell us some trends about how, with generally with age, how much more contaminated with microplastics rockfish can be. And he is specifically looking at edible tissue because that's what people care about. I mean, there's a couple other important sites like the gut where generally microplastics first enter the body that Jordan's looking at. But at the end of the day, the edible tissue is what we really want to be sharing with the anglers who volunteer for CCFRP are the ones catching these fish and eating them. It's really great to have this collaboration because it's a direct way for us to communicate this important science with the people who really care about it. The anglers who go out on CCFRP trips really do want to know how many microplastics are in their fish.
Sure. Yeah. And I think you find that in general, anglers care a lot about the fish they catch because they want them to be healthy and they want them to be there to catch in the future for their grandchildren and everything. So, yeah, there's that aspect.
Yeah.
What makes you most hopeful or, feel like the work you're doing is so important about microplastics in the future?
Well, I like to think that, we have all this problem, these problems with plastics and microplastics pollution, but I'm always impressed by the level of innovation going on with ways to combat microplastics and general plastics pollution. And there's lots of new science coming out on ways to clean up microplastics from the environment, both with technology and also with microbes. And there's more development on ways to create greener plastics or general non-plastic packaging that's much more sustainable. And I see these articles all the time, and there's a lot of great teams of scientists that are actively working on ways to minimize single-use plastics. And then in tandem with that, I talk to a lot of people who share this mindset of really being hopeful and trying to eliminate single-use plastics. And there's a lot of people who are really concerned about the issue and who are really trying to make a difference. And I feel like moving forward, as a society, we are starting to come to terms with the consequences of plastic pollution and really gonna try to make a difference and try and move away from these harmful chemicals. And in the meantime, we are trying to track microplastics and plastics as best as possible and understand how they move and how bad they are, so we can focus when these new innovations and strategies are ready to combat pollution in the field, that we're able to create conservation strategies and strategies for remediation based on what we find.
And I've also seen research showing that certain algae can be used to take plastics out of the environment. Are you aware of any of that kind of work? Could you tell us about what that's all about?
Yeah, there's a lot of work going on. Is called bioremediation to remove plastic from the environment. Microplastics can adhere to algae, like I was saying before, So if scientists are able to find a way to make algae able to kind of grab plastics at a scale in which it actually would be useful for remediation, that could be a possible technique in general. A lot of microbiologists right now are working on ways to create microbes that can break down plastic in the environment. And I feel like each time I see a paper about that, it's a little more efficient, a little better. It's really difficult to create microbes that will actively find plastic and break it down in the environment. But microbiologists are very clever and are coming up with a lot of cool strategies to try and create these plastic eating machines. But it's a very exciting kind of research, I think, bioremediation, because it allows for a more natural way of removing this and breaking down these pollutants in the environment.
Well, Zeke Spooner, a PhD student at UC Davis's Bodega Marine Laboratory, thanks for sharing your research on microplastics in the marine environment with us.
Thanks very much for having me, Dave.
Thanks again to our guest, Zeke Spooner, from the Pasparakis Lab, which is part of the UC Davis Bodega Marine Laboratory. You can check out more about the work being done there at marinescience.ucdavis.edu. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.